Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, members of the 74th Congress. 2 days ago, a number of gentlemen from the House of Representatives called upon me and with complete propriety presented their reasons for asking me to approve the House of Representatives bill providing for the immediate payment of adjusted service certificates. In the same spirit of courtesy, I am returning this bill today to the House of Representatives. As I told the gentleman who waited upon me, I have never doubted the good faith lying behind the reasons that have caused them and the majority of the Congress to advocate this bill. In the same spirit, I come before you dispassionately and in good faith to give you as simply as I can the reasons which compel me to give it my disapproval. Under the Constitution, I address this message to the House of Representatives, but at the same time, I am glad that the Senate, by coming here in joint session, gives me opportunity to give my reasons in person to the other house of the Congress. As to the right and the propriety of the President in addressing the Congress in person, I am very certain that I have never in the past disagreed and will never in the future disagree with the Senate or the House of Representatives as to the constitutionality of the procedure. With your permission, I should like to continue from time to time to act as my own messenger. Eighteen years ago, the United States engaged in the World War. A nation of 120 million people was united in the purpose of victory. The millions engaged in agriculture toiled to provide the raw materials and foodstuffs for our armies and for the nations with whom we were associated. Many other millions employed in industry labored to create the materials for the active conduct of the war on land and sea. Out of this vast army, consisting of the whole working population of the nation, 4¾ million men volunteered or were drafted into the armed forces of the United States. One half of them remained within our American continental limits. The other half served overseas. And of these, 1,400,000 saw service in actual combat. The people and the government of the United States have shown a proper and generous regard for the sacrifices and the patriotism of all of the 4¾ million men who are in uniform, no matter where they serve. At the outbreak of the war, the President and the Congress sought and established an entirely new policy in order to guide the granting of financial aid to soldiers and sailors. Remembering the unfortunate results that came from the lack of a veterans policy after the Civil War, they determined that a prudent and sound principle of insurance should supplant the uncertainties and the unfairness of direct bounties. At the same time, their policy encompassed the most complete care for those who had suffered disabilities in service. With respect to the grants made within the lines of this general policy, the President and the Congress have fully recognized that those who served in uniform deserved certain benefits to which other citizens of the Republic were not entitled and in which they could not participate. In line with these sound and fair principles, as we know, many benefits have been provided for veterans. During the war itself, provision was made for government allowances for the families and other dependents of enlisted men in the service. Death and disability compensation was provided for casualties in line of duty. The original provisions for these benefits have been subsequently changed and liberalized many times by the Congress, and later, generous presumptions for veterans who became ill after the termination of the war were written into the statutes to help veterans in their claims for disability. As a result of this liberal legislation for disability and for death compensation, 1,140,000 men and women have been benefited since the close of the war. During the war, the government started a system of voluntary insurance at peacetime rates for men and women in the service. Generous provision was made for hospitalization, for vocational training, for rehabilitation of veterans. You are familiar with this excellent care given to the sick and disabled. In addition to these direct benefits, Congress has given recognition to the interest and welfare of veterans in employment matters through veteran preference in the United States Civil Service, in the selection of employees under the Public Works Administration, through the establishment of a Veterans Employment Unit in the Department of Labor, and through provisions favoring veterans in the selection of those employed in the Civilian Conservation Corps. Many states have likewise given special bonuses in cash and veterans preferences in state and local public employment. Furthermore, unemployed veterans as a group have benefited more largely than any other group from the expenditure of the great public works appropriation of $3.3 billion made by the Congress in 1933, and under which we are still operating. In like manner, the new $4 billion Work Relief Act seeks to give employment to practically every veteran who is receiving relief. We may measure the benefits extended from the fact that there has been expended up to the end of the last fiscal year more than $7.8 billion for these items in behalf of the veterans of the World War, not including sums spent for home relief or work relief. With our current annual expenditures of some $450 million and the liquidation of outstanding obligations under term insurance and the payment of service certificates, it seems safe to predict that by the year 1945, we will have expended $13.5 billion. This is a sum equal to more than three-fourths of the entire cost of our participation in the World War, and 10 years from now, most of the veterans of that war will be barely past the half-century mark. Payments have been and are being made only to veterans of the World War and their dependents, and not to civilian workers who helped to win that war. In the light of our established principles and policies, let us consider the case of adjusted compensation. Soon after the close of the war, a claim was made by several veterans' organizations that they should be paid some adjusted compensation for the time they had spent in uniform. After a complete and fair presentation of the whole subject, followed by full debate in the Congress of the United States, a settlement was reached in the year 1924. This settlement provided for adjustment in compensation during service by an additional allowance per day for actual service rendered. Because cash payment was not made immediately, this basic allowance was increased by 25%. And to this was added compound interest for 20 years, the whole to be paid in 1945. The result of this computation was that an amount 2.5 times the original grant of 1924 would be paid at maturity in 1945. Taking the average case as an example, the government acknowledged the claim of $400 to be due. This $400, under the provisions of the settlement, with the addition of the 25% for deferred payment and the compound interest from that time until 1945, would amount to the sum of $1,000 in 1945. The veteran was thereupon given a certificate containing an agreement with the government to pay him this $1,000 in 1945, or to pay it to his family if he died at any time before that date. In effect, it was a paid-up endowment policy, in the average case, for $1,000 payable in 1945 or sooner in the event of death. Under the provisions of this settlement, the total obligation of $1,400,000,000 in 1924 produced a maturity or face value of $3,500,000,000 in 1945. Since 1924, the only major change in the original settlement was the Act of 1931, under which veterans were authorized to borrow up to 50% of the face value of their certificate. The face value as of 1945. 3 million veterans have already borrowed under this provision, an amount which with interest charges totals $1,700,000,000. This bill before me provides for the immediate payment of the 1945 value of the certificate. It means paying $1,600,000,000 more than the present value of the certificate. It requires an expenditure of more than $2,200,000,000 in cash at once for this purpose. It directs payment to the veterans of a much larger sum than was contemplated in the 1924 settlement. It is nothing less than a complete abandonment of that settlement. It is a new straight gratuity or bounty to the amount of $1,600,000,000. It destroys the insurance protection for the dependents of the veterans that was provided in the original plan. For the remaining period of 10 years, they will have lost this insurance. This proposal, I submit, violates the entire principle of veterans' benefits, so carefully formulated at the time of the war, and also the entire principle of the Adjusted Service Settlement of 1924. What are the reasons? What are the reasons presented in this bill for cash payment of these certificates at that time?
They are set forth, these reasons. They are set forth with care in a number of whereas clauses at the beginning of the bill. The first of these whereas clauses states as reason for the cash payment of these certificates at this time that it will increase the purchasing power of millions of the consuming public, that it will provide relief for many who are in need because of economic conditions. and that it will lighten the relief burden of cities, counties, and states. The second whereas clause states that payment will not create any additional debt. And the third whereas clause states that payment now will be an effective method of spending money to hasten recovery. These are the enacted reasons for the passage of this bill. Let me briefly analyze them. First, the spending of this sum, it cannot be denied, would result in some expansion, especially of retail trade. But it must be noted that retail trade has already expanded to a condition that compares favorably with conditions before the Depression. However, to resort to the kind of financial practice provided in this bill would not improve the conditions necessary to expand those industries in which we have the greatest unemployment. The Treasury note issued under the terms of this bill, we know from past experience, would return quickly to the bank. We know, too, that the banks have at this moment more than ample credit with which to expand the activities of business and of industry generally. The ultimate effect of this bill will not in the long run justify the expectations that have been raised by those who argue for it. The next reason in the first whereas clause is that present payment will provide relief for many who are in dire need because of economic conditions. The Congress, at this session, has just passed an act to provide work relief for such citizens. Some veterans are on the relief roll, though relatively not nearly as many as in the case of non-veterans. Assume, however, that such a veteran on the relief roll served in the United States or overseas during the war, that he came through in fine physical shape, as most of them did, that he received an honorable discharge, that he is today 38 years old and in full possession of his faculties and health, and that like several million of other Americans, he is receiving from his government relief and assistance in one of many forms. I hold that able-bodied citizen should be accorded no treatment different from that accorded to other citizens who did not wear the uniform during the World War. The third reason given in the first whereas clause is that payment today would lighten the relief burden of municipalities. Why, I ask, should the Congress lift that burden in respect only to those who wore the uniform? Is it not better to treat every able-bodied American alike and to carry out the great relief program adopted by this Congress in a spirit of equality to all? And this applies to every other unit of government throughout the nation. The second whereas clause, which states that the payment of certificates will not create an additional debt, raises a fundamental question of sound finance. To meet a claim of one group by this deceptively easy method of payment will raise similar demands for the payment of claims of other groups. It is easy to see the ultimate result of meeting recurring demands by the issuance of Treasury notes. It invites an ultimate reckoning
an ultimate reckoning in uncontrollable crisis and in the destruction of the value of trading that will strike most cruelly those like the veterans who seem to be temporarily benefited. The first person injured by skyrocketing prices is the man on a fixed income. Every disabled veteran on pension or allowance is on fixed income. This bill favors the able-bodied veteran at the expense of the disabled veteran. Wealth is not created, nor is it more equitably distributed by this method. A government, like an individual, must ultimately meet legitimate obligations out of the production of wealth by the labor of human beings applied to the resources of nature. Every country, every nation throughout history that has attempted the form of meeting its obligations, which is here provided, has suffered disastrous consequences. In the majority of cases, printing press money has not been retired through taxation. Because of increased costs caused by inflated prices, new issue has followed upon new issue, ending in the ultimate wiping out of the currency of the afflicted country. In a few cases, like our own, in the period of the Civil War, the printing of treasury notes to cover an emergency has fortunately not resulted in actual disaster and collapse, but, as we all know, caused this nation untold troubles, economic and political, for a whole generation after the close of that war. The statement in this same second whereas clause, that payment will discharge and retire an acknowledged contract obligation of the government, is, I regret to say, not in accordance with the facts as I see it. It wholly omits and disregards the fact that this contract obligation is due in 1945 and not today. If I, as an individual, owe you, an individual member of the Congress, $1,000 payable in 1945, it is not correct, it is not a correct statement for you to tell me that I owe you $1,000 today. As a matter of practical fact, if I were to put $750 into a government savings bond today and make that bond out in your name, you will get $1,000 on the due date 10 years from now. My debt to you today, therefore, cannot under the remotest possibility be considered to be more than $750. The final whereas clause, stating that spending the money is the most effective means of hastening recovery, I think is so ill considered that little comment is necessary. Every authorization of expenditure by the 73rd Congress in its sessions of 1933 and 1934, and every appropriation by the 74th Congress to date for recovery purposes has been predicated not on the mere spending of money to hasten recovery, but on the founder principle of preventing the loss of homes and farms,
of saving industry from bankruptcy, of safeguarding bank deposits, and most important of all, of giving relief, of giving jobs through public work to individuals and to families faced with starvation. These broader, these greater concerns of the American people have a prior claim for consideration at this time. They have the right of way. There is before this Congress legislation providing old age benefits and a greater measure of security for all workers against the hazards of employment. We are also meeting the pressing necessities of those who are now unemployed and in need of immediate relief. In all of this, in every one of these measures, every veteran shares. To argue for this bill as a relief measure is to indulge in the fallacy that the welfare of the country can be generally served by extending relief on some basis other than actual deserving needs. The core of the question is that a man who is sick or under some other special disability, because he was a soldier, should certainly be assisted as such. But if a man is suffering from economic need because of the depression, even though he is a veteran, he must be placed on a par with all of the other victims of the depression. The veteran who is disabled owes his condition to the war. The healthy veteran who is unemployed owes his troubles to the depression. Each presents a separate and a different problem, and any attempt to mingle the two problems is to confuse our efforts. Every veteran on relief will benefit only temporarily by this measure, because the payment of this sum to him will remove him from the group entitled to relief under the rules of the relief agencies which have been unanimously adopted and unanimously approved. For him, this measure would give, but it would also take away. And in the end, he would be the loser. The veteran who suffers from this depression can best be aided by the rehabilitation of the country as a whole. His country, with honor and gratitude, returned him at the end of the war to the citizenry from which he came. He became once more a member of the great civilian population. His interests became identified with its fortune and also with its misfortune.
Some years ago, this was well said by the distinguished senior senator from Idaho. The soldier of this country cannot be aided except as the country itself is rehabilitated. The soldier cannot come back except as the people as a whole come back. The soldier cannot prosper unless the people prosper. He has now gone back and intermingled and become a part of the citizenship of the country. He is wrapped up in its welfare or in its adversity. The handing out to him of a few dollars will not benefit him under such circumstances, whereas it will greatly injure the prospects of the country and the restoration of normal conditions. It is generally conceded that the settlement by adjusted compensation certificates made in 1924 was fair, and it was accepted as fair by the overwhelming majority of World War veterans themselves. I have much sympathy for the argument that some who remained at home in those war years remained at home in civilian employ, enjoyed special privilege and unwarranted remuneration. That is true, bitterly true. But a recurrence of that type of war profiteering can and must be prevented in any future war. I invite the Congress and the veterans, with the great masses of the American population, to join with me in progressive efforts to root a recurrence of such injustice out of American life. But we should not destroy privilege and create new privilege at the same time. Two wrongs do not make a right. The Herculean task of the United States government today is to take care that its citizens have the necessities of life. We are seeking honestly and honorably to do this, irrespective of class or group. Rightly, we give preferential treatment to those men who were wounded, disabled, or who became ill as a result of war service. Rightly, we give care to those who subsequently have become ill. The others, and they represent the great majority, are today in the prime of life, are today in full bodily vigor. They are American citizens who should be accorded equal privileges, equal rights to enjoy life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, no less and no more. It is important to make one more point. In accordance with the mandate of the Congress, our budget has been set. The public has accepted it. On that basis, this Congress has made and is making its appropriations. That budget asks for appropriations in excess of receipts to the extent of $4 billion. The whole of that deficit was to be applied for work relief for the unemployed. That was a single-minded, definite purpose. Every unemployed veteran on the relief rolls was included in that proposed deficit, and he will be taken care of out of it. I cannot, in honesty, assert to you that to increase that deficit this year by $2.2 billion will in itself bankrupt the Treasury of the United States. Today, the credit of the United States is safe. But it cannot ultimately be safe if we engage in a policy of yielding to each and all of the groups that are able to enforce upon the Congress claims for special consideration. To do so is to abandon the principle of government by and for the American people, and to put in its place government by and for political coercion by minorities. We can afford all that we need, but we cannot afford all that we want. And I do not need to be a prophet to assert that if these certificates due in 1945 are paid in full today, every candidate for election to the Senate or to the House of Representatives will in the near future be called upon in the name of patriotism to support general pension legislation for all veterans, regardless of need, regardless of age. Finally, I invite your attention to the fact that only from the point of view of the good credit, that solely from the point of view of the good credit of the United States, the complete failure of the Congress to provide additional taxes for an additional expenditure of this magnitude would in itself and by itself alone warrant my disapproval of this measure. I well know the disappointment. The disappointment that the performance of my duty in this matter will occasion to many thousands of my fellow citizens. I well realize that some who favor this bill are moved by a true desire to benefit the veterans of the World War and to contribute to the welfare of the nation. These citizens will, however, realize that I bear an obligation as President and as Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, an obligation which extends to all groups, to all citizens, to the present and to the future. I cannot be true to the office I hold if I do not weigh the claims of all in the scales of equity. I cannot swerve from this obligation. I am thinking of those who served their country in the Army and in the Navy during the period that convulsed the entire civilized world. I saw their service at first hand, at home and overseas. I am thinking of those millions of men and women who increased crops, who made munitions, who ran our railroads, who worked in the mines, who loaded our ships during the war period. I am thinking of those who died in the cause of America, here and abroad, in uniform and out. I am thinking of the widows and the orphans, of all of them. I am thinking of 5 millions of Americans who with their families are today in dire need, supported in whole or in part by federal, by state, by local governments who have decreed that they shall not starve. I am thinking not only of the past, not only of today, but of the years to come. In this future of ours, it is of first importance that we yield not to the sympathy which we would extend to a single group or class by special legislation for that group or class, but that we should extend assistance to all groups, to all classes, who in an emergency need the helping hand of the government of the United States. I believe that the welfare of the nation, as well as the future welfare of the veterans of the nation, fully justifies my disapproval of this measure. And therefore, Mr. Speaker, I return without my approval House of Representatives Bill number 3896, providing for the immediate payment to veterans of the 1945 face value of their adjusted service certificate.
joint session is now dissolved, and the senators will return to the chamber.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States has just delivered to a joint session of Congress his veto of the Batman bonus bill. This, incidentally, has been the first time in the history of the nation that the President of the United States has come and addressed Congress personally in delivering a veto of any bill up for consideration. The President is now being escorted out by two committees, one a committee of the House of Representatives appointed by Speaker Burns, and the other committee of United States Senators appointed by the Vice President of the United States. He's passing directly in my vision at the moment, followed by a huge delegation of the senators who are now leaving the chamber. You heard the tremendous applause which greeted the conclusion of the President's message. Every possible seat in the House of Representatives has been filled today. Even the aisles in every doorway has been used as a vantage point. Today's address by the President will again set in motion the legislative mill to grind again to answer the question of whether the President's judgment shall be upheld or overridden. It seems a foregone conclusion that the House of Representatives will cast aside the opinions of the President and vote conclusively to make the Patman bill a law. In the Senate, the question carries another aspect, though the battle may be nipped and tucked to a conclusion. Both sides claim victory, but none can tell the answer until the gavel has fallen on the last vote of the last senator in the Senate. This is Larry Elliott speaking to you from the Capitol in Washington, D.C., and returning you now to our New York studios.
We wish to thank Louis-Philippe Incorporated, who sponsor Marie, the little French princess, for relinquishing their broadcast period in order that we might present the address of President Roosevelt just concluded. For the duration of this period, we hear the Columbia Salon Orchestra offering Chrysler's Liebesfreude.